From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections Healthy Friday. I have some sad news for our listeners this hour. Comedian Harris Whittles is best known for being a co-executive producer at the television program Parks and Recreation. He was found dead in his Los Angeles home yesterday of an apparent overdose. Investigators are still looking into the details of exactly what happened there. This month, a year ago, Fairport native Philip Seymour Hoffman died of an apparent overdose from heroin. I mentioned these two celebrities and their deaths, but their deaths are part of a sharp increase in the number of people who are dying in this country from heroin overdose. Police say the drug is more readily available than it was in the past and is often cheaper than many prescription drugs. Consequently, police and medical examiners have seen a sharp rise in overdoses in recent years. We're going to be looking into the numbers, talk about some of the consequences for our community, and discuss some of the possible solutions, including different approaches to recovery. We'll be talking about all of this, and we hope that you'll check these types of conversations out online, all part of understanding the Affordable Care Act and other health reporting that we're doing. Check us out, WXXI.org/ACA. In the studio, we have a full studio this afternoon. We've got Mark Winsberg. He's a clinical director of Rochester Regional Chemical Dependency. Thank you very much for coming. We've got Jim Wesley, who's the drug chemistry supervisor at the Monroe County Crime Lab. Welcome.
Thank you.
Paul Jacoby is a therapist with Rochester Regional Chemical Dependency. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And we've got Colin. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks.
So what is the problem? What are we looking at? Jim, you and I spoke on the phone at length yesterday. You said there's some history there of people becoming addicted to prescriptions. And you really believe that there's a connection with prescription opioid abuse turning into a heroin problem in this country.
There's a lot of anecdotal reports and publications, but what we did was we pulled together all the crime lab data from the nation over 13 years, and we tracked the oxycodone and the hydrocodone as the top two narcotics. What we noticed on the graph is beginning, it ramped up over 10 years. It was almost like the stock market, and it peaked, both of those, in 2011. And by the way, alprazolam did too. And then after 2011, in 2012 and 13, there was a substantial drop in the oxy and a drop in the hydrocodone locally between 2012 and 2013 from all the agencies. And we do 8 counties and 55 police agencies, so this is a combined data. Our oxycodone submissions went down 50% in 1 year. At the same time, 2012, 2013, and now the data from 2014, the heroin just kept ramping up. So it seems to be, as the oxy availability went down and the I-Stop and the other programs went in to kind of control the prescriptions, the heroin just absolutely took its place and became the drug of choice.
Is that something that you're seeing as well, Dr. Wesley?
Yes.
Winsberg, sorry.
That's exactly what I'm seeing. I do outpatient opiate treatment clinic, treatment for opiate addicts. And it's the rule rather than the exception that that the people usually tell me, I get a drug history from them, and they say, I had a knee injury, I was in a car accident, I had a sports injury, whatever, and the doctor prescribed Vicodin or Percocet, and I found out that I liked it, and I started asking for more prescriptions from the doctor when I really didn't have the pain. And if the doctor went along with it, the dose was increased. The doctor may have given me OxyContin instead of the Percocet. And then got to a point where the doctor figured out that this wasn't for pain, that I'm hooked on this stuff, and I got cut off. And street availability has gone down. It's more expensive. Heroin's cheap. And I hear that story every day.
Yeah, well, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are saying that 3 out of 4 of the new users of heroin started with some sort of an opioid drug before that. And not everyone who starts with an opioid prescription ends up on heroin, but many of the people who are on heroin started with a prescription drug. And it sounds like that's the experience and that's what's playing out. But what happens, doctor, when a person has pain and needs medication? I mean, I know that doctors have to think about a possibility of a dependency later, but people do have pain and that needs to be treated.
Right. Opiates are fantastic medication for acute pain. The problem comes when people are being treated for chronic pain. That's where the problem arises. If someone comes in the emergency department, I used to be a emergency doctor for about 17 years, using intravenous or oral opiates is very effective if someone comes in with a kidney stone or some other dislocated shoulder. They're fantastic. The problem with them is that everyone who gets opiates on any kind of long-term basis will build up a tolerance to them. It'll take more and more to have the same effect. So the problem isn't as much with giving opiates acutely, it's giving the prescriptions and continuing to treat somebody's pain with that. And there are other modalities, other medications, physical therapy, acupuncture. There's lots of different ways of treating chronic pain. So, that's how people get into it. And, the other thing that I was going to mention is that as an ED doc, when I became aware of this issue, and it wasn't early on, I was blissfully ignorant of the addiction problem. When I'd prescribe them, I would ask a person, have you ever had difficulty with dependence on any substance, alcohol or drugs? And if they said yes, then I would preface my giving a prescription, if I gave a prescription for an opiate, that you need to be very, very careful with this because it's very easy to become dependent on it.
Now, Colin, you have a history. You're in recovery right now. How long have you been in recovery?
I've been sober about 5 months now.
5 months. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you come to using heroin the same path? Is it a similar story for you?
Yeah, I actually started using the oxycodone in around 2011, and it was pretty quick for me. Less than a year later, in 2012, I started using heroin for that exact reason. It was got very expensive very quickly because I built a tolerance, and heroin was less than a third of the price that I was paying. So it just made financial sense to me to move on to that.
Where were you getting the oxy? Was that the prescription from the doctor?
No, I actually, me and my friends started using it just because we were experimenting with different drugs, and I had never experienced going through a physical withdrawal before, and then when that came, I didn't have a problem for a while paying for it, and we got it just from people in our town or drug dealers in the city or whatever. It was pretty available at that time, but like I said, it got rarer and rarer and more expensive.
Talk about the availability. I mean, we can talk about it all the time, people who aren't out looking for it in the streets, but you have some experience finding, how easy was it for you and your friends to find heroin?
Heroin is very easy to find. There's places in the city that are just open air drug markets, and if you drive down the street, people will holler at you and tell you that they have heroin or cocaine for sale. It's extremely easy to get it.
And what's the cost? What are we looking at?
It's usually like $10 a bag, which is like 0.1 grams.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So very inexpensive.
I did a comparison on availability, and I looked at, I just pulled 20 cases at random from 2000 and 20 cases from 2013. And these are all arrests. By the way, all my data is from arrests, so this is not legitimate use of any of this stuff. Comes in from the PDs. And in 2000, 15 of those arrests just had heroin, which meant that those 20 people that were arrested, the only thing they were selling was heroin. And the other five had, four out of the five had marijuana and one had coke, meaning if you, like Colin said, if you wanted to get heroin in 2000, you really had to hunt down heroin. Now, if I look at 2013, only 10 of the cases were just heroin. The other ones are multiple drugs. Cocaine, heroin, marijuana. Cocaine, heroin, marijuana, ketamine. In other words, the same person that's selling you pills or selling you powdered cocaine or rock cocaine has heroin, has pills. It's a one-stop shop, making it much easier for someone who wants heroin to find the heroin.
Paul Jacoby, are you saying the same thing when you have people coming in with you for recovery, that they were able to find it easily, that there was a cost issue and there was a benefit cost-wise to moving from another more expensive drug to heroin?
Yeah, I mean, I think the process of addiction, you know, really is about how can I get my needs met and how can I do that the most effective way possible. So when cost and finances are, you know, a part of that, people are going to look at, you know, how can I get the most bang for my buck? And how can I continue that high or continue that, you know, positive feeling in a way that's going to not have a lot of, you know, negative repercussions, you know, on am I breaking the law or am I, you know, stealing for people who are going to miss it? So if I can find a more effective way to do that, then I'm going to.
What is this process? You mentioned a process of becoming addicted. What are some of the factors that we could say, well, this person is likely to become addicted? How does that begin?
Well, I mean, you know, looking from the model that was in the DSM-4, it was, you know, certain criteria that needed to be met. Today, I think we're moving more towards a continuum or a spectrum of addiction and dependence, and how that looks, you know, varies from person to person. Beginning, I think, is about need meeting. How am I going to get my needs met of feeling better, feeling good? Typically, you know, people are in a process of experimentation with other less hard drugs, so to speak, but they're still trying to get that, you know, high of feeling good. And tolerance is built up, and then we see people starting to, you know, move on to other chemical compounds that are going to give them a higher level of feeling good, a greater high, so to speak, and then that continues to really become a, I guess the hierarchy is supplanted of like how important drugs actually become, or that high actually becomes. So within that, we see people making really poor decisions socially for themselves, health-wise, and that becomes far more secondary. Or even, you know, tertiary in a lot of respects, and starts kind of going down the hierarchy. So the most important thing is how do I feel good and how do I keep that feeling of feeling good?
How do you get most of the referrals that come in?
Our referrals vary from schools around the area, other health organizations in and outside of Rochester, and sometimes even other facilities that are, you know, might be full at the time or not be able to take a specific person based on age or location. The demographic was too difficult for them to get to. So I think a lot of, and we also have self-referrals and through the Drug Corps program. So there's a multitude of ways we're seeing people come in.
When people are coming in, what is this pattern of treatment? I'll start with the doctor. How do we start when someone comes in, they're having a problem, maybe they were referred because they're in trouble with the law, maybe they were referred by a family member, maybe they chose to come in. I mean, those would be different reasons or different ways to approach recovery.
Yeah, it depends if someone is coming in for outpatient treatment versus inpatient treatment. Frequently, patients coming from drug court are being mandated to inpatient treatment, and they stay for whatever length of time their insurance will pay for. That's a different topic. During which time they go through lots of groups and educational sessions on what it is that they're dealing with, what addiction is, and then they usually graduate to an outpatient program, treatment program, and depending on what their need is, they'll sometimes be referred to supportive living, halfway house, that sort of thing.
And what about medical help? Say a medication to help you wean you off of?
Yeah, you're referring to the most common one is Suboxone. It's similar to methadone, actually. It's a long-acting opiate. And when methadone treatment was started in the 70s, I believe, the logic of it is that when you get somebody on an opiate, a long-acting opiate, that if you dose correctly does not get them high but keeps them from going into withdrawal, it takes them off the merry-go-round of short-acting opiates, which is getting high 4 to 6 hours later, I'm coming down, I got to find money, I got to find drugs, get high again, and it's a all-consuming addiction. So when we can use medications like methadone or Suboxone, it allows for a person to get their life back together, basically, to feel normal, to not be afraid that they're going to be going into withdrawal, and to participate in recovery activities.
And do you use that with all of your patients, or is there a different way? What are some of the approaches? So in preparing for today, I read an article with a drug court judge who just really was very much against using Suboxone, using methadone, just saying it should be abstinence-only approach. What are the pros and cons to those two approaches?
The pros are that you're not treating with another addictive medication, so that's a good thing. However, not very many opiate addicts are able to stop on their own. And even though the vast majority of addicts know that opiate withdrawal is not lethal, alcohol withdrawal, benzodiazepine like Valium, Klonopin withdrawal, those can be life-threatening. Opiate withdrawal in and of itself is not, but that fear of the feelings that people get when they're going through withdrawal are amazing. My mentor, Dr. Charlie Morgan, who's the medical director at Norris Clinic, used to say that the most common symptom of opiate addicts in inpatient treatment is they leave. And the reason they leave is they don't want to experience withdrawal. So we call it medicated-assisted recovery. It seems to be a reasonable choice. It's not the only choice, but quite a few people do well with an integrated recovery program, which means, yes, Suboxone, but not that alone. The failure rate on Suboxone alone is around 85% people relapse. If you combine that with a recovery program, outpatient programs, 12-step programs, the success rate is much higher.
How does it work chemically, Suboxone?
Suboxone's an opiate. It works just like heroin, the oxycodone, hydrocodone. It binds to the opiate receptors. And what's interesting about it is that the experienced opiate user does not feel high when they use Suboxone. They feel normal. You could say it's a weak opiate. It's strong enough to keep you from going to withdrawal, but it doesn't get you high. It just the thing I hear most is, it makes me feel normal. Okay. And that's what we're going for, because you know, we want to get off that merry-go-round of craving and using and whatever.
Paul Jacoby, what is the other piece? We're talking about the medical piece. What happens when someone is in treatment? They need some emotional support, some psychological support. How do we go in that direction?
Well, I mean, once acute withdrawal is kind of overcome and, you know, stabilization has taken place, physical stabilization, you know, we start looking at what each person's experience has been to lead up to this point, you know, and who they are as an individual. Because I think, you know, the process of recovery is extremely specific and individualized rather than, you know, just generalized. I mean, there's different, you know, methods that we use in a broader sense, but how one person relates to that and is affected by that treatment process versus another is very unique. So looking at how we meet each individual's needs is a very important part of that process, and really getting the feedback from, you know, the people that we're serving, our clients. I think relationship development is extremely crucial and important early on in that, because there needs to be a level of trust that's developed within that, you know, therapeutic
between
relationship.
Between the therapist and the client.
Absolutely. Okay. Because if there is no trust, then, you know, how am I going to assist someone who is always going to be leery of my motives, as well as, you know, how am I going to give someone trust if they aren't willing to, you know, open up to some of the suggestions that we may have. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it.
Colin, what brought you into recovery?
Pretty much just the circumstances that I was in. I had some legal problems, and also I was just, you know, homeless, living on the street and broke and no job, and just basically my circumstances. I had hit a point that I was so emotionally drained that I didn't want to live the way I was living anymore.
Did you lose contact with your family because of drug use, or did you go to drug use because of a loss of relationship?
Yeah, I definitely lost contact with my family because of the drug use. I was, you know, stealing from them and just not being a good son, pretty much. So they didn't want to enable me anymore, and they didn't want to, you know, they were scared of, like, who I was becoming and what I was doing and where I was, and they couldn't deal with that anymore, so...
And since you've been in recovery, have you been able to repair that to some extent?
Yeah, I have a good relationship with my parents today, and I'm super grateful for that. They're very supportive of my recovery, and they understand that at a certain point, there's a loss of choice. But I have a good relationship with them today because of all the positive decisions that I've been making. So
Paul Jacoby had mentioned this building a trust relationship. Talk to me about how that looked from your perspective.
Well, you know, I don't really, like, for me, like, if there's a professional that's trying to help me, like, I'm gonna trust them, because this has been their career for a long time, and I know that they're there to help me. I know that, like, this is their job. I'm in a residential drug treatment program, and they are a primary therapist here. I pretty much trust them right off the bat.
But not everyone is going to come in with that perspective. I mean, just having spoken to people who've had problems with drugs and alcohol in the past, sometimes people are very, especially if they've come in through maybe drug court or something like that, they're leery of anyone who's in a place of authority, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm part of a system. So I'm a cog in that wheel in so many ways. And how someone is going to look at that is going to be very different based on their experiences with larger systems, some of the negative repercussions they've had, and, you know, some of the maybe upsetting or, you know, distrustful relationship they've had in the past with other professionals.
Now, we're talking mostly about recovery, but we're talking about recovery because there is a danger here. I mean, Jim Wesley, you and I have spoken about some of the numbers in this at the beginning and in the intro. A sharp increase in people who are dying from overdose of this drug. What are we seeing?
Well, I can't comment on the actual deaths, because that would actually come out of the ME's office, and I don't have that data. What I have is the data of everything that's coming in. And we basically took a look at all the cases, which is over 300 of them in 2014. And we wanted to see what was in the actual heroin, because that was brought forward to us to look at it. So let's just kind of – I'm going to kind of summarize it. This kind of represents, because it's from so many different agencies, kind of a general – realization of what's going on in Rochester. So let's say there's 100 heroin cases out there. In other words, you're going to go in 100. What's in the 100? Well, 55%, so say you go out, this person goes out to buy heroin, 55 of those people, on average, are just going to get heroin. There's nothing else in the deck. But then the question is, how much is in the deck? And this is fascinating. A person might be selling heroin that's averages about 30 milligrams in the deck. Years ago, it was all about 20 or 30 average. But say they go out and they buy heroin, it's 20 milligrams. But in their pocket, they have 10 milligram and 30 milligram decks as well as the 20. So you could buy half as much or twice as much. If you have, say, 40 milligrams in a deck, and these are stats off of thousands of decks, that person could have 13 milligrams in a deck or 96.
Okay. Could you break that down? Because we're just putting a lot of numbers, we're talking about a deck, and I think a lot of listeners who don't know what that is.
So a deck is like a bag.
Okay.
So if you're a user and you say, I want one bag of heroin, and that's what you're used to using, and you think you're getting 30 milligrams, you could be getting 15 milligrams or 80, meaning if you get half as much, it's not that much, but you could be getting two or three times, meaning you're really shooting up three times as much as you thought.
So the dosage that you're getting is higher than what you're expecting?
By a factor of sometimes three.
Okay.
So you could overdose just because you have so much. And if you were to, I don't want to get graphic, but if you were to put it on a spoon and you were to look at 15 milligrams as opposed to 30, it's very hard in the small amount of heroin to see how much is there. It's a very small pile. So that's the 55 out of 100. Well, how about the rest of the heroin? The biggest cutting agent in Rochester is caffeine. So it's heroin with caffeine, essentially like a weak speedball. The caffeine, and really, I'm not going to testify to that. Well, I think I'm in court. But the caffeine itself is a stimulant. About 2 or 3% is heroin and xylazine. Xylazine is a horse tranquilizer. So if you
it's a double downer.
Oh, a double downer. If you happen to be the unlucky person that gets that, you could have some serious issues, including death. And then a couple percent is heroin and fentanyl. And I know that was discussed with Hoffman, tainted heroin, and that's what you hear in the news. And is there a lot of tainted heroin? As a percent, you would say, what's 2%? If 2% of all the heroin in Rochester is tainted, is that so bad? Well, if you take 8,000 decks, which is what I have in the database, and you take 2%, that's 160 decks on the street. And each one of those has heroin and fentanyl. And ask the doctor, that could kill you. Fentanyl is going to put you down. And people don't know that. They don't know they're getting that tainted fentanyl-laced heroin, and it's here in the city.
Okay. You mentioned some of the stats from the Monroe County Medical Examiner's Office, and I did get some data. Most of these are large charts, but you can definitely see numbers from January 2011, and it just keeps going up and up and up and up until December 2014. Yeah. And 2014, it looks like the largest numbers, 21 deaths in October 2014.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
I mean, it's shocking because if you look at Andrew Bourdain did a piece on Massachusetts, and central Massachusetts near Springfield, they don't have an answer for it. They're starting task force. The dads are dying, the moms are dying, the kids are dying, the dad and the kid died, and no one has an explanation, but a lot of people are dying.
Yeah. And when we're talking about those numbers, the heroin-related deaths occurring within Monroe County increased from 47 in 2013 to 80 in 2014. That's a 70% increase. Those are the numbers that we got from the Monroe County Medical Examiner's Office. So it is a large increase. We're seeing a lot of people, less than 100 people, but when you look at the larger Monroe County, this is, it's not a huge county in this country.
And it also includes, especially now, the people that would have died, but the naloxone brought them back. And then as more and more EMS and police start to have naloxone, you're going to see people that would have died that were actually saved by having the Narcan.
We'll be talking about Narcan and naloxone and more questions about recovery after we take a break. I'm Michelle Faust. This is Connections Healthy Friday from member-supported public radio. I'm Michelle Faust, and you're listening to Connections Healthy Friday from a member-supported public radio. And we're talking about heroin addiction. We're talking about possible solutions and some large numbers of increases of people who are dying from overdose. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have a question about recovery or anything to do with the subject, give us a call, 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. And as always, if you'd like to learn more about this subject or any of our health-related topics, check us out at WXXI.org/ACA, and you can join the conversation with the hashtag ACAWXXI. We're in the studio with Dr. Mark Winsberg. Paul Jacoby works with him at Rochester Regional Chemical Dependency. Colin is here talking to us about his journey through recovery, and Jim Wesley from the Monroe County Crime Lab. Now, right before the break, we were talking a little bit about distribution of a drug that helps people interrupt an overdose. It's naloxone. There's some other names for this drug. And Dr. Winsberg, can you talk to us about what are these drugs that people can get to stop an overdose?
Well, naloxone or Narcan is the antidote to an opiate overdose. And there's a group called the Harm Reduction Coalition that is based in New York City. I believe there's branches throughout the country who floated the idea in the early 2000s about getting naloxone into the hands of users so that if they're around someone, one of their friends, one of their fellow users, and they see that they've overdosed and they've stopped breathing, they're turning blue, they have the capability of reversing that process. So it's continued to develop through the years, and we're now, the New York State, just this last summer, funded the giving out naloxone kits. And my focus and the Harm Reduction Coalition focus is, let's get these not only into the hands of EMS people, but into the hands of the people that are going to be there when it happens, either the users or parents, or, you know, who's going to be there at that time. And there are programs going. We started one at the John L. Norris Clinic. We're training the inpatients, whoever wants to be trained, in how to use the naloxone kit. And they're given that kit when they're discharged from inpatient. At Strong, I know Dr. Gloria Bishevitz and Patrick Sesh have gotten a regular program, training program, where they're giving out these kits. I believe Trillium Health is also doing it. And we're very close to starting it at Unity, at Rochester Regional Health as well. So the way it works, it's very, very simple. In this kit is are two vials of naloxone, and depending on the kit, some of them, early on we were giving out syringes and little vials of naloxone. Now the state is paying for the intranasal version, which is more expensive, but more acceptable to the general public. So these kits contain two vials of naloxone, a little atomizer that you screw on the syringe, and if you see somebody that's possibly overdosing, you just spray the stuff in their nostrils, and it can reverse the death. I mean, the death from the overdose.
How does it work? How does it work chemically? You said it's the antidote, but I mean, that seems almost magic to me. I mean, what does it actually do chemically?
Well, in your brain, on all the brain cells are opiate receptors. And the way opiates work is that when you inject them or take them orally, they get into your bloodstream, go to your brain, and it's like a little lock, and heroin is the key, and it goes and fits in that lock, and then you get the effect of the heroin. What naloxone does is it goes in and it kicks that key out of the lock and blocks it, so it can't go in. And that's a good thing. It helps the, you know, it keeps the person alive. The person getting the naloxone is probably not going to appreciate it because they will wake up in instant withdrawal. However, and they'll just think you just wrecked their high. Yeah. They won't understand that you just saved their life.
Yeah, I actually just recently did a story about nurses who get injured on the job. And one of the first interviews I did about that was a nurse who had gotten punched by someone who had just gotten Narcan.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it sounds like you're shaking your head. That's something that you're familiar with.
Yeah, that's the effect. And it's different for different people. If somebody had just used three bundles of heroin, the Narcan will probably wake them up. They probably won't be in instant withdrawal. But if they've used less than that, likely they will be in some level of withdrawal after receiving it. And the important thing to remember in using these kits is that naloxone only lasts for about 30 to 60 minutes. And the drug, whatever opiate has been injected or ingested, hangs around a lot longer than that. So it's possible that you can revive somebody with one of these kits. You inject or insufflate the naloxone, they wake up, and half an hour later, they're back down. And that's why in these kits, the procedure is call 911, then give the naloxone, and don't let the person, when they wake up, don't let them use more, and, you know, help get them to the hospital.
I mean, is that actually a risk? Is that something that you see, that people are coming down and they want to shoot up again, or they want to try the drug again?
I haven't seen it personally, but from working in the emergency room, there are lots of times where we would give a certain medication for a procedure. Say, I mentioned dislocated shoulder. You frequently have to use fairly large doses of opiates when you do that. And the pain that the person is experiencing, all the adrenaline, everything that's going on, keeps them awake. Once you get the shoulder back in place, there's still all that opiate in there, and the adrenaline is going down. That we have to watch them very carefully, because somebody could die after a procedure like that in the emergency room. And the same goes for using the naloxone in the field. It only lasts for a little while. The drug is still there, and you know they can become, they can start dying again.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you've been shaking your head. Yes, this is something that you recognize.
Not now. When I worked at the hospital back in the day, and I used to work the Saturday shift, and it was in a city hospital, and we would have people that would happen. They would sign themselves out against medical authorization, and then we'd have to pick them up in the parking lot because they would collapse back in the parking lot, and then the ambulance would bring them back in. So it did happen. On occasion where we, and now, especially if this was to happen now in the snow with minus 20, that could be a huge, huge issue.
Wow. I guess it's shocking. I think from my perspective, you know, addiction is a really strong thing, Paul Jacoby. I mean, to almost die and then do the drug again and possibly kill yourself again.
Yeah, I think in those moments, you know, those of us who have never experienced a process of active addiction in our lives are going to look at it from, you know, why would someone do that, from a rational perspective. But when you're in the middle of an active addiction and dealing with that, rational thought really goes out the window. It's how important, that is how important getting high is at that moment in time. And any, you know, harm to self or harm to others can really be, again, become secondary or even less than that on that hierarchy of what is the most important thing I need to do next. And I don't think it's that conscious of a thought. It's really almost reflex at that point, or second nature, because it's about, you know, having that drive kind of overcome you.
Mm-hmm. Colin, you mentioned that you had experimented and then that led to heroin. Was there something that preceded that? Do you think that there was something in you that you were maybe a thrill seeker, or were you, was it a coping mechanism? What do you think brought you to using drugs in the first place?
Well, I think for everyone, there are different reasons. For me, it was pretty much, like when I first started using, I was about 12, and I didn't really feel like I had very many friends.
How old are you?
I'm 20 now.
Okay.
So, and that was marijuana when I first started. And I just kind of did it because some of my friends were doing it, and I just kind of wanted to fit in, you know what I mean? It was like a have fun type of thing with my friends that I could do on the weekends to start out with. And I don't really know the exact point where I became addicted, but, you know, it's a progressive disease, and it can happen to anybody, so...
We've talked before about, you know, people hear in the media this thing, peer pressure. But I've talked to young people who said, you know what, my friends don't really care what I do. Did you feel that there was a peer pressure issue, or was that an internal thing that you wanted to fit in? I mean, where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, nobody really was like, oh, you gotta try this or anything like that. It was more of an internal thing for me personally.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, one of the things I come across in talking with a lot of people is that peer pressure is really looked at as it has to be that outward influence of, hey, man, do this, where peer pressure can really just be that desire to be social, to be engaged in the group. And we can then fall into that trap without even realizing it. But it's the pressures of, you know, the social interaction rather than them actually being thrust upon us by our friends.
Not to give away my own age, but when I was young, it was all just say no. Just say no, and everything is going to be okay as long as you stay away from this in the first place. There's been some research that says that didn't work quite well. Is that because people are approaching it, coming to drugs for different reasons?
I mean, I think that's a large part of it. I think ultimately that, you know, our society is very pain avoidant, and we just don't like to feel discomfort or kind of any level of being out of sorts, if you will. And I think that the more we try to have fun, the more we try and push those limits, especially in a process of experimentation with drugs and alcohol, then that line continues to get pushed further and further back. And that is, you know, speaking to the progressive nature of building tolerance, going on to the next or better high. And I think that overall, we need to start looking at what some of the systemic factors of addiction really are. And again, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to that specifically, but it's more about what each individual is going through and how we can understand that process and how the individual has the answers a lot of the times. They just need to learn how to find them or sift through them.
Okay, what are these systemic factors of addiction?
I mean, I think a lot of it can be looked at from an emotional perspective. How we deal with or are allowed to deal with, you know, our emotions in society openly. I think there are a lot of other factors that go into why someone gets involved in a process of addiction, and that could be socioeconomic status, you know, having the means to do so, not having the means to do other things, and finding that being a good alternative. I think the list is, you know, vast. I think we just need to be able to hone in on some of the key elements within each person's process, and that, again, goes to how to build that relationship, really understand some of the other factors that have been going on in a person's life, and not just pathologize it and saying, you know, this person is an addict, but really they're dealing with an addiction, and how did we get there?
So we're talking a bit on the back end, but what about prevention? How do we get involved ahead of time to keep young people, or, I mean, the numbers, if we look at a lot of these people who are dying, who are addicted, they're in their 20s and their 30s. It's a very large peak if you look at the spread of the age difference. How do you get involved with someone when they're young and keep them from going that direction?
I mean, I think outreach programs are huge in the sense that we need to be able to talk about not just negative consequences, but really, you know, better alternatives to exploring experimentation. Because a lot more than not, young people are going to try something that is kind of taboo, or that is going to give them a desired effect, even if they don't know what that effect is. You know, word of mouth is one of the most powerful elements of, you know, persuasion in young communities. So how we, again, influence that in a positive sense and continue to have that open dialogue rather than hide away from it or not talk about it is going to be far, far more of a benefit to, you know, society at large.
Dr. Winsberg, we talked about a lot of people coming from a different opiate and then going to heroin, getting that legally prescribed from a doctor. What about other drugs that have a similar profile of other illegal drugs? I mean, a lot of young people are put on Ritalin and other things like that. I mean, this is something that's happening from a very young age. Is that related to use of other drugs?
Definitely. We're getting people coming in for inpatient treatment for dependent on lots of different drugs. It can be Adderall, it can be marijuana. You know, there's a lot of feeling because it's being legalized in lots of different places, and that's a whole different discussion, that marijuana is not a harmful drug. But if somebody is smoking two or three blunts a day, and blunts are cigars of the marijuana, which is much more potent these days than it was back in, I won't say how long ago or how old I am, but it's there. It's addictive, and there's people are coming in with cocaine addictions, other prescription medicines. There's Neurontin is a medicine that's mainly used for seizure disorders. Can be used as a mood stabilizer as well. People are starting to get that off the street. There's all different sorts of drugs that that people are using that they become dependent on. And I did want to mention that one of the problems with the DARE program, I think, was that I've never experienced it. I didn't see what they would say, but my understanding is that it was presented in this catastrophic terms, like if you use marijuana, you're going to become a heroin addict. And 13, 12, 13, 14-year-olds aren't stupid. And the fact is that that the vast majority of people that experiment with marijuana or alcohol or with other drugs don't become dependent on them. But there is a certain percentage, and it's about 10 to 12% of the general population that will end up having a problem with whatever drug, whatever substance.
We have a caller on the line. John from the city has a question, and we're going to make it brief because we are running out of time.
Okay, Michelle. Colin mentioned he started with marijuana, and a lot of young people that I've known over many years got serious drug addictions starting out with innocent marijuana, and society sort of poo-poos the seriousness of the marijuana epidemic as a gateway drug. My second point is, does tough love work in the doctor's opinions?
Okay. Thank you.
Generally, no. As far as opiate addiction is concerned, you know, there are a certain number of people that might respond to that, but when a person stops using opiates, there are cravings that remain for quite a long time, and tough love or no tough love, I think that's one approach, but it's generally not that effective.
And I just want to jump in on that as well. The I think that's a much older approach of how we've used to address treatment, and that we found, it, like you're saying, doctor, that it's not as an effective an approach because long-term abstinence or even life changes that result from it are negligible. I think, you know, what we're looking at today is how to really embrace a process of empathy more and start connecting with people rather than, you know, judging or, you know, giving them ultimatums. Setting boundaries is really important in this process of addiction, but doing that with love and compassion is essential.
Okay. Now, I'm going to give Jim Wesley the last word because he's looking at me like he has something more that he wants to add, and we're running short on time.
I just want to throw, if you look at the UN data on drugs from all over the world, I think sometimes we think of ourselves isolated, but here's the fact. With 4.6% of the world's population, we use 99.9% of the world's hydrocodone. 99.9. We have the highest use of methylphenidate, of Ritalin. We have pretty much the highest use of almost all drugs, including street drugs. So maybe we need to look, I don't want to say Europe as a model, but something to see why, as Americans, do we just consume so many more drugs at such a high quantity than pretty much the rest of the world?
That sounds like an interesting conversation, but we'll have to have that in the future. As you know, we've talked about a lot of different factors, and we could probably go on for another hour. But our time is drawing short. I want to thank all of the guests in studio. We'll start with Dr. Mark Winsberg from the Rochester Regional Chemical Dependency Organization. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also from Rochester Chemical Dependency is Paul Jacoby. Thank you very much for being in the studio.
Thanks again for having me.
Colin, thank you for sharing your conversation and your own experiences. That's very useful to our listeners. And Jim Wesley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming from the Monroe County Crime Lab. Thank you for our listeners and our callers. And John, behind the glass, you've been listening to member-supported public radio. I'm Michelle Faust. This is Connections Healthy Friday. Don't forget to check us out online, wxxi.org/ACA.